Limon Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. May Martinez. With hundreds of fires burning up California, the cash-strapped state will continue to rely on President Trump for help. But how long can it continue to play nice when he can't stop saying not-so-nice things about California? Plus, how often do you go back to watch videos of black people killed by police? We'll hear why they shouldn't even be there to consume in the first place. It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for being with us. Coming up, the argument against sharing and airing videos of police shootings caught on tape.
A lot of the humanity is lost when we just loop these videos with the casual air of a sports highlight.
More on that in about 20 minutes. But first, I know we've talked a lot about wildfires this week and also last week, but the thing is, they're still here, chewing up the state. And it seems like a big part of California's working relationship with the Trump administration right now revolves around fires. Also, the Los Angeles Times made a presidential endorsement. Pretty sure you can guess correctly who they chose, but it's the way they endorsed him that caught my eye. We'll jump into all that on State of Affairs. That's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And joining us are Zach Corser. He co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Also, Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Now, guys, now, some of the president's favorite things to have an opinion on are, well, just about everything and everything. But usually, whenever there's an opportunity to say something about California, he usually does. Carla, what has he said about a recent wave of forest fires?
Pretty much nothing. And this is the shocker, really. I mean, the California and the West are on fire, but President Trump, we haven't heard anything from him. He has tweeted, he's gone golfing, he's held news conferences galore. He's appeared at the campaign rallies and even the national convention. But in the past 3 weeks, we've had 42 large fires scorching the western states. That's putting 28,000 firefighters out there. And the damage of 4.5 million acres when you talk about Oregon, Washington, and California together. And really, the last time he spoke about this was in reference to California, was more than 3 weeks ago when, he said, basically, the forest fires are starting, but you got to clean up your floors and forests. I mean, he went to the whole fire management issue, even saying that, well, maybe we're just going to have to make them pay for it because they don't listen to us. So this is raising eyebrows, I have to say. We're dealing with historic proportions here in California. And as we know, you've mentioned this, California now facing the biggest fire in 170 years of history here. Meanwhile, we're under these orange skies and some of the worst air conditions we've seen in a long time. So this has been a real contrast, I got to say, too. We've heard from Joe Biden on this. We've heard from Kamala Harris, even Barack Obama. They've tweeted sort of empathetic messages to California. I think it's raising eyebrows that, Mike Pence has said something. He's talking about how his son-in-law lives in California, but we have... It's been radio silence from President Trump on this one.
You know, Carla, on that question of forest and fire management, Newsom said today, sure, it's been imperfect, but that's not everything that's going on here.
The reality here is the mega fires that we're experiencing come from these mega droughts that we've experienced. There's something else going on, not just bad past practices over a century related to forestry.
Carla, was that in response to Trump or was he trying to get at something else?
And I think he's trying to address what he says is a lot of misinformation. I mean, he just called it outright BS in his press comments. He was very impassioned about this. It goes to the issue of things, a lot of misinformation and efforts by conservatives to suggest California is at fault for what's going on here in California. They have brought up for years the issue of forest management. People like Devin Nunes have repeatedly said that environmentalists have been at fault for refusing to cull timber, to allow private companies to cull timber and to build fire roads. But the bottom line is, and Newsom got to this, the federal government isn't without guilt on this whole situation, but they own almost half the land in California. But the fact is, mega droughts, a heat dome that California just experienced with dry lightning fires, And just years and years of effects of climate change have come to a fore here. And as you said, what you're seeing in California now, you're going to see in the rest of the country. He really gave a stark wake-up call today.
Zach Corser, Carla mentioned how Mike Pence mentioned yesterday on Fox News that his daughter and his son-in-law live in California. He wanted to assure firefighters, business, and homeowners that they'll have federal government support. Zach, what federal help has actually been provided to the state?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We seem to be back in a dynamic between Newsom and Trump like we were experiencing early on in the COVID crisis, where Newsom is very praiseworthy in terms of, you know, saying things like he's grateful for Trump's support. Meanwhile, Trump and the GOP use California as a political punching bag. But what's interesting is quietly, support is being given to the state. You know, the Trump administration, for as much as Donald Trump beats up on California, you know, we have been receiving grants. There's been five different disaster declarations. Federal personnel have been assigned here. Helicopters have been assigned. There is aid coming, but there's kind of this rhetorical dance that goes on where, you know, Trump attacks California, but the sort of personal relationship between him and Newsom is nuanced somehow.
Zach, okay, if it's at all possible to extract the Trump administration's bluster from this and have an objective analysis of how they've handled aid to California, how would you grade it?
Well, you know what I'd say? I'd say that this is a shared responsibility between California and D.C. I think what we really need here is not these kind of reactive measures, but we need a real plan for environmental adaption and resilience. This is a kind of growing policy area that states like Louisiana have had to deal with this because they have been affected by climate change more dramatically than other states. But we can see the hotter, drier climates in California. And the fact that we're going to have to start facing up to the fact that reducing carbon emissions isn't enough. Climate change is here. And we've got to adapt by building new infrastructure to deal with it. Now, it's going to be really expensive. And that's one of the major reasons why we need the help of the federal government to do it. But I think as we see these terrible fires playing out, as we look to future droughts and other disasters, it's going to be a lot costlier to do nothing.
You know, about the threats, we've talked before about how Gavin Newsom seemingly has to play nice with the president because the state obviously needs the money. I mean, I've watched them both. I'm sure you two have both watched them when they tour a fire-damaged area, and I don't know who is more uncomfortable to be standing next to the other. Carla, how much anxiety do you think Sacramento really has over its seemingly fraught relationship with D.C.?
You know, I think there's a tremendous amount of anxiety, especially right now when you're talking about a state that is drowning in red ink because of the COVID crisis. Gavin Newsom has been slammed by a couple of different crises at once. So the issue is about money. You know, you mentioned Trump and Newsom getting together. Last time was last year before he even took office. And it was one of his first days in office when Newsom announced, you know, California spending, you know, millions and millions of dollars to thin forests, et cetera. And that's when Trump promised federal funding to cover up to 75% of California's cost to remove that debris. But, you know, there's been some signs that that stuff is going on sort of under the covers here. The former Department of Homeland Security official Miles Taylor said that Trump told them to stop giving money to California because it didn't support him and politically wasn't a base for him. So that is going to be concerning when Newsom is looking for real help from the federal government in very big dollars to control this devastation that's going on. And so far, he did say today that he had a half-hour conversation with Trump yesterday. And that was, something that a lot of people in Sacramento welcomed. So at this point, Newsom is still holding that door open that he's going to get more help from President Trump. And it suggested today that it looked good.
Zach, there was a time before cell phones, before social media, where all of this maybe bending of the knee by governors to whoever happened to be in the White House, we never really saw it. At least I don't remember. Is this kind of how it's going to be going forward, regardless of who's president? That governor, if they're not in the same party, has to kind of just bend the knee a little bit.
Well, I certainly hope not, because I think, you know, America has changed quite a bit in terms of the separation between state governments and federal governments. You know, we see a lot more what's called cooperative federalism, where states and the federal government are working together and cooperating largely because the federal government has the resources to help, and the states are in need of them. And a lot of times the federal government can kind of call the shots because they have so much money with which to attract states to their preferred policy preferences. But at the end of the day, states have a lot of power, and I think states should recognize, and I think Newsom has, I mean, before the COVID crisis, California, and I think led by Newsom, was making it very clear that California was going to challenge the federal government where they thought that the federal government was overstepping or was stepping outside the bounds of what California found acceptable. So, I mean, I find that not necessarily adversarial relationship to be healthy, but at least, you know, states should demand and draw clear lines in the sand that the federal government, you know, has its particular remit and the states have theirs and they should defend it.
Talking State of Affairs with Zach Corser, co-director of the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College, and Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. I know I said bend the knee a couple of times. I got to get my Game of Thrones reference in one State of Affairs once in a while. Now, all right, so when it comes to homeowners and fires, there's been a very long debate over whether Californians should build and live in homes in or near fire-prone areas. And Gavin Newsom, I've heard him say that he will not tell people where they can live or they can't live. But I'm wondering maybe if that is maybe somebody going to be dictated by insurance companies. Zach, how would that happen?
Well, you know, it's interesting in this, you know, California already has a fire insurance plan, basically an insurer of last resort where it becomes too expensive or private insurers no longer wish to assume this risk. And I think what's going to happen is what's happened already to flood insurance. You know, the national government, the federal government stepped in and created a national flood insurance program. And what they've tried to do with this program is basically try to figure out ways to incentivize and disincentivize people living in very risky areas. In fact, there's various areas along the coast where you just can't receive flood insurance. There's no private coverage because no one wants to cover it. And the federal government has basically said it's too risky to build there. And I think what's going to happen likely over a period of time is that development is going to be discouraged in these areas and insurance will be harder to get because they'll just be places that are too risky to live due to climate change.
So you could see a future then, Zach, where homeowners just can't afford to live in places because they can't find insurance to live there?
Well, another analogy from flood insurance, I think, is we shouldn't look at it as not being able to afford to live there. We should look at trying to help people adapt and be more resilient to climate change, giving them grants and credits for adapting their homes and property to withstand the new threats of hot, dry weather, not underwriting unacceptable risks by the public and encouraging a kind of moral hazard for people to live in places that are really too dangerous to live in.
Carl, I know there's a ballot measure coming up in November that could help people who want to leave a high-risk fire zone. Tell us about the pros and cons of Prop 19.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. I mean, right now, property tax is based on the price you paid for the house when you bought it, and it stays that way as long as you stay in the house, which makes it easier for boomers like myself. It always has. If you're in the house for decades, you get a lower property
tax.
Not that far behind you, Carla. Yeah. But that's, and there's the issue there. But people who lose their homes in fire areas lose that tremendous advantage, and then trying to move into another area, a lot of times they're not going to get that kind of break on their property tax. So this was an issue that came up by the supporters of Prop 19, and this has been backed by big realty groups, basically allows seniors and those with disabilities and victims of natural disasters to keep that property tax benefit tied to their current homes if they move anyplace else in the state. Now, of course, that for fire victims, that sounds great. I have to say, there are those, particularly my millennial kids, who say, wait a minute, you boomers have gotten plenty of benefits. That's why none of us can afford a house in California. So I don't think it's necessarily a slam dunk. I think this is going to be a debate that goes forward. Of course, the realtors are putting big money on this, but this is something that could be a game changer for a lot of people because it allows that property tax transfer anywhere in the state, even to a home of greater value. And that's this one reason, though, however, that the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association is opposing it because inherited properties are exempted from that, or are not exempted from that, and they think they should be. So there, that's some of the issues. The supporters say it could generate $100 million a year for the state.
Now, switching gears, I know I talk about my conservative uncle a lot, but this time I'm talking about my my liberal brother. So he is a huge Bernie Sanders supporter, but when we were doing our fantasy football drafts this week, one of his Joe Biden-backing friends asked my brother if he was going to vote for Biden because at least it wasn't a vote for Trump. Now, yesterday, the Los Angeles Times' editorial board endorsed the former VP, saying, Trump's record easily justifies a position of anybody but Trump. But Biden isn't just preferable to Trump. In many respects, he is Trump's antithesis. Zach, we're 53 days away from the election. Why do you think it was important for the Times to make the distinction that Biden is more than just a quote, anybody but Trump choice?
Well, you know, I think this is what the convention, the Democratic convention, was largely about, was answering this question. You know, who is Joe Biden? Because in politics, you can't beat something with nothing. And there was a concern because of COVID and our altered social reality that you can't sort of do the same kind of campaigning you used to. And so Biden was kind of in his basement in Delaware, and people were concerned, you know, who's Joe Biden? What does he stand for? And I think, you know, going into this race, we're 53 days away. Biden has, you know, I think the case is well made, particularly to people who want a change that, about Donald Trump. We're not going to learn anything new. What we have to do, or what he has to do, is really think carefully about why should people vote for Biden? Because look, the race is tightening. I was just reading this morning in the Cook Political Report that Amy Walter moved Florida from a lean Democrat to toss up, and Nevada has moved from solid D to lean lean Democrat. So the race is tightening here in the final lap, and Biden has to make a positive argument for voting for him, not just voting against Donald Trump.
My brother just texted me, and he wanted everyone to know, and it made very clear that just because he likes Bernie and that he's my bro, that he is not a Bernie bro. That's, I'm not kidding. He wanted to make absolute clarity that that is the case. All right. Now, since we're talking about voting, there are some fresh numbers out on who is potentially heading out to the polls this November. Carla, what's that breakdown?
Well, you know, California Secretary of State's office came out with new numbers. And yeah, I mean, the news for the Republican Party is they're still number three in California, just shy of becoming number two. Look, the party that's winning, I think, most in California is the NPP's no party preference. Yeah. Right now the Democrats are still ahead. Republicans are 10,000 votes short of becoming the party's the state's second largest party. Democrats have added are now at up to 46% of the voters. And that's what the situation right now is. The Republican Party is still challenged in California. When you talk to the leaders here, they say they believe they can make some gains. They can, and they can hold on to that CA-25 seat in Northern LA County. Mike Garcia won it during that special election. But the fact is, still challenged because of the numbers, because of Latino voters, still growing group, because of suburban women, because of African American voters. So Republicans still have a major challenge in California to even get out of the cellar here.
Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Zach Corser co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Zach, Carla, have a great and safe weekend, you two.
You too, guys.
All right, what do you do when you hear there's a video of a black person killed by police? Do you sprint to a screen to see it? Well, a lot of us do because, well, we all know some news show will be airing it over and over and over again. But should they be? And should you be such an eager consumer of black misery? A USC professor says no and tells us why these images eventually need to be put to rest.
A lot of the humanity is lost when we just loop these videos with the casual air of a sports highlight.
She's coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Sun, little darling, here comes the sun, I say. it's all right. It's all right. Here comes a sun, little darling. Here comes a sun, I say. It's all right. It's all right.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Mike Brown, Philando Castile, George Floyd. These are just a few of the black men whose deaths at the hands of police have been documented in videos, then put online for the entire world to see. And more recently, and closer to home, there was also the shooting death of 29-year-old Dejan Kazee by Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies. Now, these videos spark outrage, protests, and widespread calls for social justice. But what's the emotional impact on us when we watch them? How are these videos used by the media? And how do we remember the people whose deaths we see in real time? Here to discuss all of this is USC professor Alyssa Richardson. She's the author of the book Bearing Witness While Black, African Americans, Smartphones, and the New Protest Journalism. Professor, when did you start writing this book, and what was going on in our society at that time?
Yes, I began writing this book in 2014 when Mike Brown was killed. And I saw during that time so many different groups of African American youth, especially, picking up their phones to record some of the most heinous film that I'd seen in a very long time. And as a journalism professor, I don't take that lightly. I've seen a lot of things. But to see that these images were coming from young people who knew that their devices were perhaps the only thing that stood between them and their own personal safety, and to see them put their bodies on the line to record this, these human rights injustices, really captivated me. I thought they were incredibly brave, and so I interviewed a number of them for the book and followed them for a couple of years. I followed them until 2017, actually, and I thought that this book would actually be written in retrospect. I thought it would be a historical piece. Mm. But then the killings this summer of Mr. Floyd really brought into sharp focus for me how this is not going anywhere. It's not going away anytime soon. And the fact that we have cell phones to see everything in all of its detail complicates how we want to go forward with what we should do with this footage.
Yeah, it's one of those things, Professor. You know, before the dawn of smartphones, there was always something that would happen when it comes to police and people of color where you'd think, man, if we only had video, if we only had a camera nearby, right? It was one of those things where we kind of wish for it and things would be different if, but it really hasn't turned out that way.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons why many of the African Americans I've interviewed recently have said they've stopped watching them. In the beginning, around that 2014 time frame, there was a lot of hope that these kinds of videos would bring justice and that families would finally be able to lay their loved ones to rest, knowing that a police officer who took their loved one's life at least would be held responsible or held accountable for that. But since we have not seen that, by and large, a lot of folks feel like these films are sacrilegious to watch now, almost. And it seems as if when you watch them, knowing that there may or may not be a resolution, it takes the dignity away from the victim who is featured there. A lot of the humanity is lost when we just loop these videos with the casual air of a sports highlight. And that's what I saw happen this summer with Mr. Floyd's video being played over and over again on cable television. And I saw it again recently with Mr. Blake being shot in the back. Now, considering that his kids were in the car and that we've had kids in the car before, if we think about the case of Philando Castile and his 4-year-old stepdaughter being in the back seat, as a mom, I would want those images scrubbed from the internet as soon as possible.
Now, I want to ask you in a second about how you decide to watch these videos or not. But before we get to that, you're a professor of journalism. So I'm wondering if you'd consider these videos, which are shot, you know, more often than not just by regular, ordinary people. Is it journalism, kind of like citizen journalism?
Yes, absolutely. I consider it citizen journalism. And I always, with my really nervous students at my journalism school who wonder if they will still have a place in this ecosystem, I stress to them that this is an EMT model, where these brave people are EMTs and they are first responders. They are the ones who are on the scene, who are at the right place at the right time, and they are capturing something that journalists may have missed. But just like an EMT, you take that footage and then you hand it off to the professionals. And that's the model that we've seen. Most of these citizen journalists shoot the footage and then they retreat from view, having handed it off to a professional like you. And what I'm asking for is that professional journalists then, as they're entrusted with that footage, just as a surgeon would be very careful with the patient after they come off of that gurney from an ambulance, I'm asking that we are really careful about how we deal with that footage that was shot during duress.
Now, with George Floyd, I remember hearing from a lot of people that at first they didn't want to watch the video. They didn't want to see another black man die in the hands of police. When there is a video of brutality against a black person, how do you decide for yourself? First, professor, as a human being, not a journalism professor, not anything like that. As a person, how do you decide whether you're going to watch it or not?
It's very difficult. I don't watch all of them anymore. I used to have to watch all of them as in the process of writing the book and in the process of making sure I had all of my facts straight. But now, just as a mom, I try to make sure that I don't expose my children to these images inadvertently. When I'm watching the television, for example, and just last night there was a segment on the impact of cell phones, for example, on these types of justice. And Mr. Floyd's video just came up unannounced without any kind of trigger warning or anything. Those kinds of things bother me a great deal because I see, as a black woman myself, in some of these victims, I see my dad, I see the face of my brother. And my son, who's 6 years old. And so to have to look at yourself being brutalized over and over again is something that's unique to the black community. No one else has to really watch themselves die on primetime television every other night.
We're talking to USC professor Alyssa Richardson. Her new book is called Bearing Witness While Black, African American Smartphones, and the New Protest Journalism. Now, wondering, professor, for people who are not black or who have not been profiled by police, these videos can give physical proof of a story that the African American community, that black Americans have been telling everyone about for generation after generation. So in that respect, there seems to be a social value to them. Do you buy that argument?
I do, to a certain extent. This technique was used before. It was called the shadow archive, and it was what W.E.B. Du Bois and Ida B. Wells used to do when they repurposed lynching photographs. They would actually use those to a point of agitation, and they would put them in their magazines and newspapers like The Crisis and let people know what happened. But once they got everyone's attention, they retired those photographs. They made sure they were in a vault somewhere, or in a library, or in a museum. And that's what I would like to see happen to these, just as we've made sure to give white people dignity when they pass away. We need to do the same with black people. If we think about the images of Daniel Pearl being beheaded, or we're coming up on the anniversary of 9/11, and we used to have those photographs live online of the people who were forced out of those buildings. We have found a way to retire the images of Daniel Pearl. We found a way to retire the images of those who were killed senselessly during the September 11 attacks, or even the many videos that used to exist online of mass shootings. Like, there were several that captured the mass shootings in Las Vegas. And there were many videos that captured people falling down, never to rise again. And it horrified me to see those videos. And so I was glad that those family members got to have those videos removed from the web so that their loved ones would not be entombed online.
But you know what? Rodney King video is easy to find anywhere. You can find it just about anywhere you want, anytime you want it. On your phone, too, if you wanted to.
That one is a bit different because it existed in a time where cell phones, of course, did not have video. And the handy cams were even more difficult to come by. They were very expensive. And so Mr. Holliday actually did, when he recorded that video, is make sure that he licensed it. And so one thing that's important about that video is Mr. King did not die in that video. So the death part is the part that I have the strongest problem with is that we're actually watching someone lose their life in real time. That should not be. So that's the key difference there with the King video. I know, for example, the Holiday family, as well as the Zapruder family, even if we think about the Zapruders who recorded JFK's assassination, they are compensated for their footage. Darnella Frazier, the 17-year-old girl who recorded Mr. Floyd's killing, was not. And she is not compensated for that. And so who will pay for her care? Who will pay for her therapy that she will need? Who will pay for Mr. Floyd's children's college educations? Those kinds of ripple effects financially are another caveat that really complicate the looking. Because if we think about other people who have recorded video that has endured, they've been paid for that. These witnesses that I interviewed for my book have not been compensated and probably will not be because they uploaded it to a site that now owns it. So there's a lot of layers here that make this very complicated. And it's not just filming and being in the wrong place at the right time. There's just so much in terms of human dignity and in terms of justice, seeking justice, that make it very hard to stop this practice, you know, and I would never encourage anyone to no longer film, but it's the way that we watch them that can be changed.
Alyssa Richardson is an assistant professor of journalism at USC's Annenberg School and also the author of Bearing Witness While Black, African-American Smartphones, and the New Protest Journalism. Professor, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Back in the spring, grading kids who got online learning shoved on them seemed a little unfair, so some districts actually did things such as not giving out failing grades. But the last few months has revealed how the standard grading system may have been failing certain students the whole time. That's coming up next when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
I've never seen a diamond in the flesh. I cut my teeth on wedding rings in the movies, and I'm not proud of my address. In a torn up town, no postcode envy, but every song's like gold teeth, gray goose dripping in the bathroom, bloodstains, ball gowns, trash in the hotel room. We don't care. We're driving Cadillacs in our dreams, but everybody's like crystal Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece, jet planes, islands, tigers on a gold leash. We don't care. We aren't caught up in your love affair, and we'll never be royal.
Royals.
It's a one in our blood. That kind of luck just ain't for us.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Last spring, as the coronavirus forced schools into distance learning mode, many districts across Southern California relaxed their grading policies. In fact, LA and Long Beach Unified blocked teachers from giving any student an F last year. Now, despite these moves, experts say the crisis exposed real equity problems with how most teachers grade. KPCC's Kyle Stokes tells us about two schools' very different experiences with pandemic grading.
Back in March, 2 days after John Muir High School in Pasadena closed its doors, history teacher Manuel Rustin sent his students an assignment, an essay.
If you would have told me at that time when I sent that out that I would arrive at a place where I'm going to give all my students A's, I would be like, oh, impossible.
Not just A's on that assignment, A's for the entire semester. And this essay was the turning point. It was on segregation, a topic that Rustin's juniors had already been studying for weeks before the lockdown. Rustin said he'd practically spoon-fed the students everything they'd need to write a simple 3-page paper, class notes, documents. All they had to do in quarantine was watch one last documentary film.
And I had this big document with links to the film, links to this, links to that, and I thought it'd be fine. And it was not fine. And the essays that were done were like a whole mess.
Only about half of his students even turned the paper in. Most of those who did.
Those essays were horrible.
That was after Rustin pushed the deadline back by a week.
And that's when I realized, like, okay, I got to pump the brakes. In my head, we're all at home chilling, write the essay. In their head, the world's falling apart.
Ruston's students are mostly low income. Many didn't have working internet. They were squeezed between crises at home and a crisis at school.
Kids weren't prepared. Staff weren't prepared.
So how was Ruston supposed to grade these mostly unfinished, mostly awful essays? Pasadena Unified Policy did say no student's grade could go down last spring, but Ruston felt like giving credit for finished essays was also unfair.
Either the students who are really chilling at home in a comfortable environment, like I'm going to let them have extra credit, but the other students, like, they're just stuck.
Hence Manuel Ruston's decision. Every student in his classes last spring got an A.
I'm not giving them a mark of excellence. This is to make sure nobody else out there could look like they did better than you did right now. So I'm not giving you a trophy. I'm giving everyone a trophy. And now we don't know who did better or not, because it's just not fair to judge each other in that way right now for this one semester.
Ruston says a lot of his colleagues disagreed with him. In fact, in other schools, some teachers felt relaxed grading policies actually caused students to tune out last spring. But Duquesne University Professor Emerita Susan Brookhart says underlying all of this is a big flaw with traditional grades. Giving out points just for meeting deadlines is inequitable, especially right now.
My completing this worksheet might be no skin off my nose. You completing your worksheet might have been a huge effort because you had a fight to get it done.
Which is particularly unfair if, say, your internet doesn't work and another student's does. And besides, whether students did the worksheet or even whether they understood this one worksheet doesn't really answer the bottom line question, which is when the course is over.
Do they know the material or not?
Mark Rothney is a science teacher at Burt Corona High School in Pacoima. It's part of YPI Charter Schools. We're going to focus on his school for a moment because Rothney had basically the opposite experience as Ruston with grading last spring. Rothney's school uses a system called standards-based grading. Instead of counting each assignment for points or rewarding students for grasping something on the first worksheet,
you're assessing students on what they know, you know, like at the end. So you don't, they're not really penalized if they make those mistakes, because it's okay to make mistakes.
It sounds simple, but doing standards-based grading right involves lots of complex changes, and teachers have to be trained how to do them. Homework becomes more about practice. Teachers often don't grade it. Deadlines become more flexible. And even on projects or tests that do count, students get do-overs and retakes. But all of these attributes made Burt Corona's grading policies kind of pandemic-proof. Math teacher Nestor Garcia explains, in standards-based grading, you really don't have to worry about students' grades backsliding just because they didn't meet a deadline.
If we've already, in our judgment, said the student has mastered this skill, we can't take that back and say, oh no, the student didn't do it on the final, so they actually don't know it. If we've already seen the evidence that they do know it.
So not only did Burt Corona High School not institute a no-Fs grading policy last spring, they kept giving out grades basically as usual.
Students were still able to receive Fs, some did.
But overall, YPI Charter Schools officials say it went well. Students stayed engaged in classes, and while they don't have data to compare, they were pleased with students' scores on some internal standardized tests. Susan Brookhart, who's studied grading for 30 years, is not surprised. As distance learning drags on, a lot of schools have asked Brookhart for help with standards-based grading.
Standards-based grading has proved robust, and I've heard that, of course, anecdotes are not research data, but I have heard anecdotes like that.
Pasadena teacher Manuel Ruston was intrigued, too. While he says it isn't always fair to compare a charter school like Burt Corona with a district-run school like his, he did hope over the summer that he could learn standards-based grading and use it this year. But he didn't have training. He would have been going it alone at his school. And besides, for much of the summer, he didn't even know whether his classes would be all online or partially in person.
So right now, I'm pretty much doing it the way I've always done it.
This semester, Ruston says he's not going to give out any Fs, and he says his all A's days are behind him for now. Still,
I'm glad I broke away at least for a moment, at least for that, like, you know, one semester giving them all A's and standing by my principles of not wanting to punish a kid or let a kid be disadvantaged.
And so far, this semester is going way better than last spring. Rustin says students are logging in, much more engaged, and much less panicked about the world outside of school. Covering education, I'm Kyle Stokes.
The great John Horn is the host of the LAS Studios podcast, Hollywood the Sequel. He's also a colleague. I consider him a friend. He's also a theater geek, a big one. As in, any kind of theater, anywhere, showing any kind of show, he will go watch. Last week, John drove a few hundred miles to a theater in Las Vegas just to see the film Tenet. And then yesterday, again, he got in his car and went to see a theater show. But this time, to watch it, he stayed in his car. He'll tell us all about it when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
When your baby leaves you all alone, and nobody calls you on the phone, don't you feel like I'm crying?
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming at kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. During the pandemic, it has not been easy to get out of the house for entertainment. And if you're a big movie fan, you can head to one of the handful of drive-ins still in business and watch a film from your car. But what if your passion is modern dance? Well, John Horn is the host of the LAS Studios podcast, Hollywood the Sequel. And last night, he got in his car and went out to the theater. Okay, John, so paint a picture for all of us here. What was this event?
It is called Drive-In Dances. It's the brainchild of LA Dance Project, which is one of the top modern dance companies, not only in LA, but also the country. It was founded in 2012 by the dancer and choreographer Benjamin Mipier. You might know him as the choreographer of the movie Black Swan. Anyway, it is not possible for audiences to crowd into his downtown LA performance space, so the company said, well, what about our parking lot?
Okay, so what does that mean?
It's just like it sounds. You drive to LA Dance Project's parking lot on Washington Boulevard, a little south of downtown. You're wearing a mask. You keep it on, even if you want to roll down your windows. And you pull your car into an assigned spot facing a square outdoor stage. And there are only 8 cars total, so everybody has the equivalent of a front row seat. And you tune your radio to a low-power FM station where you hear the score to the piece, and then the show starts.
Okay, so what was the show? What was the performance?
It's a new piece called Solo at Dusk. It has 7 dancers. It was commissioned by LA Dance Project and was co-choreographed by Bobby Jean Smith. And it starts with one person all alone by herself on what I'll call the stage. It's actually just kind of a big square carpet. It has one chair, a small table, a lamp, and a record player. And this woman is sitting there all by herself, kind of like everybody is doing during the pandemic. And one by one, the other 6 dancers come out of the company's building and they join her and they start dancing. And before it started, I spoke with Smith about the performance out in the company's parking lot as the dancers were kind of stretching and warming up. And she talked about the challenges of staging a performance while following all these social distancing protocols.
It was honestly very difficult. And, you know, you try to romanticize it and find the best in it, and I think we actually managed to find a lot of intimacy inside of the distance.
So the distance is important because the dancers all had to wear masks during rehearsals and performance. And during rehearsals, she basically worked with them individually and then brought them together toward the end. And the masks aren't totally visible. One of the members of the company, the dancer Janie Taylor, designed these kind of floral arrangements that cover over the PPE masks. But that only made the performance even more physically demanding because you're trying to breathe.
Yeah.
But it's also really hard for dancers to communicate emotion because facial expressions or touching one another, those are important. And dancers are fundamentally actors and they're trying to communicate emotion. And in almost all cases, they're touching each other. So Smith talked a lot about that. Like, how do you come across and show empathy? How do you mirror a sensation without being able to hold somebody or be close to someone or actually see somebody's face? And here's what she said.
The most difficult thing was not being able to see their facial expressions. And I didn't realize that I relied on those micro gestures and those gut reactions. You know, you present an idea and you see their gut reaction to it. And without that, 2 weeks in, I'm like, why does this feel so different? This is challenging in a whole new way. But you start to see other things or rely on other actions, actions that happen more in the body, in the hands, in the feet. You start to listen to other things more loudly.
You get to do all the cool stuff, John. I swear to God, you went to Vegas to see Tenet. I mean, okay. Now, had she ever choreographed something like this before? And what did she take away from the process?
I mean, she'd done nothing like this. She wrote it during the pandemic with her partner. She had to rehearse it and stage it during the pandemic. She wasn't able to use a stage. You know, everybody's outside. But I think what she took away is that she learned different things about how to choreograph and different things about what art means and different things about what it means to get out and see art. She said it was challenging, but also worth it.
I will take away the strength of all of these amazing people that we've been able to work with and their passion and the constant drive to express and to share what we love.
And I want to add something because, you know, a lot of people have been out of work for a long time, but performing artists haven't had an outlet. You know, maybe a dancer can dance at home or dance with a partner, but they can't perform. And that's so much of who they are as artists. And I think it's really important for them to kind of express themselves in front of an audience, even if it's just eight cars in a parking lot.
Yeah, well, that had to be a great performance to watch, John. And like you said, they're just can't wait to get out there in front of eyes to see them, right? I mean, so they must have given you one heck of a performance.
Yeah, it was a great show. I've always been a big fan of this company. And while I'm not a dance critic, my wife and I found the show really moving.
John, you have the soul of a dancer.
Oh,
I know
thank
this.
You. Okay. Not the body of one. And not,
I didn't say body,
not
the soul.
And certainly not the coordination. The program says that the piece is about, and I'm quoting it now, seven individuals in the throes of loss, memory, and rediscovery. And you really get that. There's a sequence involving a couple arguing or fighting, and even though there are no words, you know exactly what's going on. And there are also many moments where the dancers in the piece are kind of looking for and not finding connections to other people on stage with them, this kind of physical longing. And it's exactly what it's like these days. You really got a sense that the dancers were telling that story.
How long was the show?
It's only about 40 minutes. So my wife and I made a dinner date out of it. We grabbed some great pasta takeout from Brera in downtown LA. Oh. We snuck in a bottle of wine. And we really enjoyed getting out. Even if we weren't fully out, we were in our car. It felt like we were out.
So, John, is this, it sounds really great. So I'm wondering if this is a one-time thing, the first of many shows. Are going to do more performances throughout the fall and maybe in the winter?
Yeah, there's going to be two pieces that are doing. The Solo at Dusk, which is what I saw last night. There's a different work by different choreographers called The Betweens. It runs through October 11th, so not a long run. But you can also live stream the performances if you sign up for LA Dance Project's subscription digital platform. And A, even if you don't want to get downtown, here's what you can do. Take your muscle car. I'm not going to say what it is. Take your muscle car, pull it out of the driveway, put your laptop on, order some takeout, watch it on your laptop, and just pretend you're in a parking lot in downtown LA.
Or the other option, John, is you take me to some of these things with you. How about that?
Okay. Once my wife says I can do that, I will. So don't
right.
Wait.
She's
too
got
long.
Priority. I understand. That's KPCC's John Horn on his drive-in dance experience. John, thanks a lot.
And I'll take you next time.
Finally, with the weekend here, if you need to find ways to get your mind off the news, then we can help you out.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. And A. Martinez, now more than ever, it's important to stay inside for your own health and well-being. But for many, it is the weekend. So here's what you can do on the couch that isn't Netflix again.
All right, so what's up first?
Well, Film Fest. Yeah, it's not Netflix, but it's different kinds of films that you're used to seeing then. Today through next weekend is the biggest Mexican film fest outside of Mexico, the 12th annual Hola Mexico Film Fest. 20 of the best films from Mexico will be streaming online. One to highlight is the second feature film directed by the famed actor and, may I say, dreamy actor, Gael Garcia Bernal. It's called Two Carotes, which is about two teens and the dreams to get out of their small town, which may involve some crime. When you want to watch one of the films from the fest, it's online and the prices vary.
I will second that dreamy designation for Gael Garcia Bernal. Now, okay, what can I do this weekend, Leo, that takes me outdoors without actually being outdoors?
So this is an air quote that you can't see. Head to the open seas. Today through Sunday is the Virtual Maritime Festival. It's a collaboration between seafaring organizations around the world, including the Ocean Institute of Dana Point. Throughout the weekend online, there will be programs like a mermaid swim, shanty singers so you can learn about the work songs of merchant seamen, tours of historic ships docked around the globe, details about marine life, and more. So it's all online, and that one's free to stream.
All right, finally, if I'm missing human interaction, but I want to be clear, I'm not. I love being alone. But if I were, what can I do?
So, A, you know this about me. I am a sucker for magic. And pandemic, I attended a play/magic show hosted by the Geffen Playhouse.
Yeah.
But tomorrow, the famous Magic Castle is doing its own interactive magic show combined with dinner. It's called Dine and Delight. It's a show that takes place via Zoom, which I promise actually does work with magic. Saturday's performers include Matt Marcy, Michael Gutenplan, and Juan Luis Rubiales. Now, it's free for Magic Castle members. However, for non-members out there, like myself, it's $20. But if you do curbside takeout from the Magic Castle's own restaurant and spend $50 in total, it's free too. So check that out and their menu online. Now, there are still a bunch more events to go to online. Find out what you can do this weekend by heading to our site, laist.com. That's laist.com. And you can find me on Twitter, at Leo Has a Cat.
And that's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, there were so many great Take Two shows this week, last week. If you missed any of them, number one, why? You know we're on it too. But okay, so if you did, just go to wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. We're also all over social media. We're on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.